Okay, come on, Buddha, light me up. Is that good? It's better? Good? All right. Let's do a little ceremony, okay? Each person say their first name, and then we all say it, okay?
Barry.
Barry.
Ann.
Angela.
Angela.
Clem.
Clem.
Larry.
Larry.
Kenny.
Kenny.
Malia.
Malia.
Linda.
Oscar.
Oscar.
Oscar. Oscar.
Karen.
Karen.
Susan.
Susan.
John.
John.
Dorley.
Dorley.
Jared.
Jared.
Jeff.
John.
John.
Jeff. Jeff.
Donna.
Donna.
Lynette.
Lynette.
Karen.
Karen.
Homa.
Homa.
Donna.
Donna. The awesome meditation theme for this retreat is Buddha activity. Are you Valerie's sister by any chance? Are you friends? No, you're sisters. Now your sisters? Okay. Now my understanding is that Zen is Buddha activity. When I first heard about Zen and began practicing Zen, I didn't think of it as Buddha activity. I think I thought of it as a kind of exercise or training, an activity which would help me become the kind of person I wanted to be. And the kind of person I wanted to be was a person who had really good relationships with everybody. I saw examples of people. I read and heard stories of humans that could relate to other humans and animals and plants and water and earth, that could relate to it in a way that was, from my perspective, really cool, really beautiful, really attractive and encouraging. They demonstrated a kind of life that seemed good for everybody. And then I got the information that these people, they had a kind of a training or a practice they did. And I guess I thought at first the practice makes you a person who can relate the way they relate. Now I understand that the practice is relating the way they relate. So the Buddha activity is the way they relate it, and the practice is Buddha activity. But it's difficult for us to understand how the way we are now is already Buddha activity. It's hard to understand that, and so that's why I offer this topic to contemplate and to discuss face to face, so that we can understand that our life is Buddha activity, really, that we're already engaged in Buddha activity. We're already engaged in Dharma activity. We're already engaged in Sangha activity. Can you hear me okay? We're already engaged in the activity of the triple treasure. Are you familiar with the term triple treasure?
Yes.
Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So part of what I'm emphasizing is that Buddha is an activity. It's a relationship, an active relationship. Dharma is also an active relationship, and Sangha is an active relationship among living beings and non-living beings. And this activity is an activity of liberation. It's an activity of freeing beings so they can dwell, so that they can live together in peace. Now, if I say to you, you are engaged in the essential activity of maintaining the Buddha way, if I say you are engaged in the essential activity of liberating beings, that may be difficult to understand. But I just said it, and I sincerely mean that. This is what we're involved in already. It's a question of realizing it fully. I think I'll start with, in a way, the simplest and also the most difficult to understand way. And then maybe later, I'll talk about the more difficult way to practice it, but easier to understand. So it's really hard to understand is how our present life is engaged in the process of freeing beings. And what might beings be interested in becoming free of? They might be interested in becoming free of delusion, fear, greed, hatred, the confinement of human consciousness. They might wish to be free of that. If we're free of human consciousness, we will be able to dwell in peace with beings and transmit that peace to beings. It's hard to understand that that's what we're already involved in. Even though I just said that's what you're already involved in, it may be hard for you to understand, or you might say, believe me, or believe those words, believe that teaching. The thing that's making it difficult to understand and, realize that situation is that we have a consciousness which discriminates between this and that, between ourselves and enlightened beings, between enlightened beings and ourselves, between ourselves and others. Because of these discriminations, we can't understand that what we're already doing is the Buddha way. Or I should say can't, don't understand. For example, if I meet someone and they say something to me and it's painful or irritating, I might respond in a way that looks like impatience. Can you imagine that? So then I might think, oh, I heard that I'm engaged in the essential working of the Buddha activity, the Buddha way. But how is my impatience? I mean, Buddhas are really good at patience, right? The Buddha way is the process of liberating beings from impatience. So now, but I'm feeling impatient. So how is me being impatient not the least bit different from freeing beings from impatience? Yeah. If I would give up, so I got the impatience, right? And over here I got the patience. I've got the being caught in impatience, and I've got freedom from impatience. I mean, I don't have that. I got the being caught in impatience, and I heard about freedom from impatience, and now I've heard that they're not the least bit different. That's the teaching that I'm offering. They're not the least bit different. But our discriminating mind sees that they're different. And if we hold on to that discrimination, which we tend to hold on to, it's kind of like they are different. Then the not different part is like, what? So I don't want to make it too easy for you, but temporarily I'll make it easy for you by just saying, here you've got freedom from impatience. Okay? The Buddha activity is freeing beings from everything. And one example is freeing them from impatience, freeing them from being caught and stuck in being impatient. That's the Buddha way. Does that make sense to you? Yeah, that's easy, right? That's good. I would like people to be not stuck in being impatient. Okay, but I'm impatient. Now, this freedom from impatience, what does it do? It isn't just being free of impatience, it is also freeing beings from impatience. The Buddha way isn't just freedom from impatience, it's freeing beings from impatience. It's not just the Buddha free of impatience. It's not just the Buddha free of greed. It's not just the Buddha free of hatred. It's the freeing of all beings from greed, hate, delusion, and impatience, and stinginess, and carelessness, and so on. The Buddha... Yeah, now it's getting a little harder, I guess. Okay, I see that freedom from hatred would be great. And now I hear that there's an activity of not just being free, but transmitting that. The Buddha activity is not just being free, it is freeing. It's being free, it's being freed, and it's freeing. Does that make sense that it might be that? The freeing part is applied to who? To what? All beings. So the freedom from impatience might get applied to what? To an impatient being. So the impatient being is holding up the impatience part of the deal. And the Buddha activity is encountering their impatience. That's what the Buddha activity does. If there's any impatience, it goes and meets it and liberates it. But it doesn't necessarily get rid of it. And then we have the expression, the horse arrives before the donkey leaves. The process of liberating beings from impatience, from unkindness, it doesn't wait to go to them until the unkindness is gone. It goes to them while they're unkind. It goes to them while they're impatient. It's working with them right now. And it's also... And not also. And as part of working with whatever kind of bondage there is, it teaches that the discrimination between the bondage and the freedom is all that makes them different. They're not different. But the discrimination between I'm stuck and I'm free is what makes the freedom somewhat different, not different, but separate, or not realized in the bondage. So one path of practice, one path of practicing the Buddha way is to give up the discrimination between what we're doing right now, each of us in a different way, each moment, what we're doing right now, and liberating all beings so they can dwell in peace, the discrimination between what we're doing now and that, if we just let go of it, they're no different. Because again, the freedom applies to our, to us, the way we are. The freedom doesn't apply to us after we change into somebody else. Like right now, I'm feeling maybe somewhat scared. It isn't that I need to be a little bit less scared and then I will be freed from fear. The way I am now and the way I am now and the way I am now, those are three different people, three different beings. Every being that I am is no different from Buddha activity. Because that's what Buddha activity is, no different from whatever way we are. If it were different, there would be no possibility of liberation, because it would only be applied to people who are free. But it's not. People who are free, they're fine. Congratulations. But Buddha activity applies to people who aren't free. There's no point in it if it doesn't free people. So the bondage and the freedom are never separate. Never separate. They're not different. Oh, and by the way, they're not the same. They're free of difference, and they're free of being the same. Patience is not different from impatience, but also patience is not the same as impatience. But people don't have such a big problem with the way they are being, you know, really great. That's okay if they find out about that. Because in fact, it's kind of true. When you're not separate from something, you're kind of the same as it, but not quite. Not completely the same, and not completely different. Just not different at all. So there's, again, so it's the one path is to give up the discrimination between what we're doing here today and the activity of Buddhas. How we're feeling today, not even today, how we're feeling right now, and the activity of the Buddhas. Are you hearing me okay still?
Can I ask a
question? Yes, you may ask a question.
Okay. This is how I'm making sense of why something that's labeled as impatience is the same as something that's patient. And tell me if this is wrong. Is that the part of me or the perception that's happening of each one is a consistent thing? So is that why they're the same? Because the perceiving instrument is the same for both? So it's awareness?
One way that patience and impatience are the same, one way that they're the same, is that they're both perceptions. I mean, I shouldn't say, they're not really perceptions, but when I see patience and I see impatience, one of the ways that is the same is that I see both of them, and I perceive both of them. So in that way, they're the same. But there's another way that they're the same, even when I don't see either one of them. Like sometimes if I look at a tree, I don't see patience or impatience. However, meantime, patience and impatience include each other. So that's a way that's the way that everything is including everything else. In particular, things include what they aren't.
Okay.
So patience, there's no patience without impatience. It has no function without impatience. But patience does have a function, a great function, because of impatience. Impatience, just again, impatience by itself is a big problem. But impatience, including patience, is freedom from impatience and also freedom from patience. Because even patience you could get stuck in. And that wouldn't be good either. Of course, you might say, well, it's worse to be stuck in impatience. And I would say, okay, yeah, it's worse. You could say so. But again, to be stuck in that it's worse is inseparable from being free from it's worse. So that's kind of like the simple thing is that we are right now engaged in Buddha activity. We always have been, and we always will be. However, because of discrimination, because we won't let go of our discrimination that liberating beings is probably different than what we're doing right now. Not to mention later today when the jets start flying over us, we might kind of think them flying those fighter jets, those aren't like, you know, passenger jets. It isn't just for the pilots to have fun in. Those are weapons of mass destruction flying around over our head. Those people, are they involved in Buddha activity?
Yes.
They are. And we don't know what they would do if they realized that. Would they then still put on this show and make a lot of noise? I don't know. But anyway, the difficult work is giving up to all distinctions, but in particular, giving up all distinctions, including this big one, that what you're doing right now is different from freeing beings so they can be at peace with other beings. But that activity must include the way we are right now. The activity, the Buddha activity, is not just that some people are getting this wonderful gift so that they can join the liberation process. That's not Buddha activity. Buddha activity is freeing all beings. And the freeing all beings is not waiting till later to work on all beings. It's not waiting until the pilots land their planes. It's working on them right now when they're not flying. And when they get in the plane, it works on them then too. That's the process that we're actually involved in, according to this teaching. But our mind can produce lots of discriminations about how that isn't so. That the pilots and the other people who are putting on this noisy show, they're not engaged in the same process as us. We're the peaceful ones. We're the ones who are remembering silence and stillness. Yes, we are. We are the peaceful ones. It's true. I agree. And sometimes some of us are not peaceful. And at that time, we're not being peaceful, right? We're living beings who are not being peaceful. And at that moment, we are not separate from Buddha activity. which is to free all airplane pilots from delusion. And they are engaged in freeing all Buddhists from delusion. That's hard. And our discriminating mind has the easy time making a discrimination about that. Like, wait a minute, I got some problems with that. Well, fine. At the moment you have problems understanding this teaching and applying it to everybody, at that moment, you're not the slightest bit different from Buddha activity. You're still in the process, and always will be, of liberating yourself from your discriminations about who is and who isn't engaged in liberating beings. But a lot of people think those pilots are not engaged in liberating beings. But some of the pilots think they are. Can you imagine? Military people sometimes think they are engaged in freeing beings. They think, I work for the United States, and the United States is about freeing beings. So that's my job. That's what they think. So if you tell them they're freeing all beings, they don't have any problem. They think they're the same as that. And we think, no, you're different from that. But in both cases, we have to let go of discrimination. And then again, I told you there's another way of looking at things, and the other way of looking at things can apply to this way of looking at things, because, in fact, we need to do a practice in order to let go of our discriminations. We need to do various kinds of practices with our discriminations in order to not be caught by them. So, let's see, it is now that time on here. And it's that time on there. And now we have, oh, by the way, before it's too late, I just want to mention that Buddha activity, which you already know, is freeing all beings, right? So they can live together in peace. Another thing I say is Buddha activity is conversation. All of us have consciousness, I think. In my consciousness, I think all of you have consciousness. And in consciousness, you're there. You know, but when I say you're there, you think it's like I'm here. Or this is me. That's consciousness. And in consciousness, we are trapped. We're also simultaneously free. But in the realm of consciousness, generally speaking, humans are trapped there. They can't see outside of it. And how does a human being become free of being trapped in consciousness? Again, in consciousness, which most human beings think, this is my consciousness. It's a state of mind that you think belongs, where there's the thought, this belongs to me. It doesn't belong to you, but there's a thought in our mind, this belongs to me. That's part of the problem of consciousness, is that it's an enclosure where there's the thought, I own this enclosure. It's a real tough situation. And also, what I think and what's being thought of in here, which are my thoughts, they're true. Anyway, consciousness. How do you become free of consciousness? Buddha activity. Or by conversation. We cannot talk ourselves out of our consciousness. A lot of people I've met, I've met a few people. And they come in and say, I'm sick of this consciousness. I'm sick of this place. Me, 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 me. That's consciousness. I'm sick of it. And then they want to get rid of it. But wanting to get rid of consciousness, of course, is what's going on in consciousness. And it just reinforces the walls of the enclosure. I want to get out of this limited, egocentric, it's not really egocentric, but it seems like it's egocentric, and that's like painful. I want to get out of Painville. That's what's going on in consciousness for a lot of living beings, who, by the way, have consciousness, but they also have more than just consciousness. They also have the unconscious and a body, and they have more than that too. Guess what else they have, folks? What?
Buddha
activity. They got Buddha activity, which isn't just what's going on in their consciousness. It's the way they're working together with everybody to free beings from consciousness. We are working to free beings from consciousness so we can live together in peace. When we're free of consciousness, we live together in peace. But we don't get rid of the consciousness. We use it as a basketball to throw back and forth to have conversations with. It's a perfectly good thing to use to have a conversation. That's the liberating use of consciousness. So Buddha activity is conversation. So now, as before, you may not have noticed it, but now we can continue with the conversation, which takes the form of people raising their hands and me saying yes, and me putting on my hearing aids. By the way, there was a historical event night before last in Berkeley at the yoga room. Karen was there and Vivian was there. I put two hearing aids in one ear. First time I ever did that. Has anybody else ever done that? Probably. But first time I did put two hearing aids in one ear, and it was uncomfortable, but I wasn't impatient. And then I became free of two hearing aids in one ear. I think Karen was first.
Let us take a mic to a person and they make the questions and everybody.
You okay with that, Karen? Being mic'd?
Hi. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
When you talk about discriminating consciousness in this way, I have two thoughts. One of them is that it would be good to give it up, and if I could, I would, but I'm not in control of that.
You're not in control of the giving up.
Yeah.
That's correct. I mean, correct means I agree with you.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, what I agree with is correct.
So I have that thought.
So stuff like that goes on in consciousness. But I still say that's correct.
Okay, so how about that?
You're not in control of your own liberation. Okay? That's not what Buddha activity is. Buddhas are not in control of your liberation. They are the process you're in right now, but they're not in control of it. You are also responsible for the process of liberation. But you're not. Buddhas are not in control of you being liberated. You're not in control of Buddhas being liberated. Now, most people know that, right? I didn't control Buddhas into being liberated. Most of you wouldn't think that, right? That you made the Buddhas liberated. Well, actually, you did, but you weren't in control of it. And Buddhas can't control you into being liberated. But they are in the process of liberating you. But they're not in control of you. And you're not in control of yourself. However, you are responsible because you have to put your life into the process. You have to donate your life to the liberation process. Of course, everybody knows Buddhas donate their life to the liberation process. That's all they are, is the liberation process. So they're totally giving themselves to it. And they're not in control. Did you get that? It's kind of important. Buddhas are giving themselves completely to the liberation of you and me and everybody, totally give themselves to it, and they're not in control. They give themselves completely to something they're not in control of. Did you hear that? Now, some people say, I'm not going to give myself completely to something unless I'm in control of it. Well, that's a person who is like in prison. And Buddhas are totally devoted to people who say, I'm not going to be totally devoted to something unless I'm in control. You're not in control of this retreat. Maybe, does that make sense to you, that you're not in control of this retreat? Does it?
Yeah.
But you're contributing to it. Does that make sense to you? If you didn't come here, there wouldn't be a retreat. You are responsible for this retreat. It was announced, you came. You contributed to it. But you're not controlling it. You're giving yourself to this retreat. And if you're trying to control the retreat, you're not giving yourself to the retreat wholeheartedly. When you give yourself completely to something, you're not trying to control it anymore. And you're responsible, even though you're not in control, and you're responsible, even though you completely give yourself to it. Now, if you give yourself to it half-heartedly, you're still responsible for it. Like if you came to this retreat, or I came to this retreat half-heartedly, I'm still responsible for it. I'm still contributing to it. What's hard to understand is that if you don't come to the retreat, you're contributing to it, but you are. All the people who didn't come to this retreat are also contributing to it in a different way. So, I'm devoted to the process of liberation of all beings, including me. And part of the way I exercise that devotion is remembering what I just said to you. If I don't remember it, I'm still devoted to it. When I do remember it, then that is the way I'm being while I'm devoted to it. So again, remembering this teaching is part of the process you're in. Forgetting it is also part of the process you're in. Yes.
The other thought that came up as you were speaking about discrimination is, in some ways, I don't want to give it up. There are things about it I love.
Love what? What do you love?
About discriminating consciousness.
Well, again...
there are some great things about it.
So part of what the Buddha activity is doing is helping people who love something to let go of it. Yeah. So, again, part of the Buddha activity is to help people understand that if you love something, in the sense of not just wanting to possess it, if you want the best for discrimination, if you want the best for impatience and hatred, if you want them to be free, then while you love them, let go of them. And they will thrive. Well, I should say, good things will thrive and harmful things will wilt if you let go of them. So you don't have to hate discrimination to let go of them. But if you do, then hating them, the hatred is opportunity for letting that go. But again, letting go is not, if you hate somebody, letting go of hating them is not something you're in control of. It's something you're responsible for. Even if you don't want to let go of hate, you're still responsible for the letting go, which doesn't seem to have happened. But you're in the process, everybody's in the process of letting go of hatred. And some people are having a really hard time with this current level of their liberation, which seems like they're totally trapped in it, which of course is really painful. It's hell to be trapped in hatred. That's what hell is. But the people in hell are in the process of becoming liberated from hell. They're not in the process of being liberated from heaven. However, they are in the process of being liberated from hell, and they're also in the process of liberating the people from heaven. So you're in the process of you being liberated from your own little neighborhood prison, and you're also simultaneously in the process of freeing people from other prisons. That's Buddha activity. And understanding and being kind to your prison, which you're not in control of being kind to your prison, but still, being kind to your prison is essential to be free of it. If you hate your prison, the walls get thicker. Other people are also in prisons, and being kind to their prison is essential for them to become free of their prison. If you hate their prisons, it doesn't contribute. It is not in accord with their liberation. So, some of us are in the prison of this retreat, and the people flying the airplanes are in the prison of the Air Force, and we're all working together to become free. That's Buddha activity. Nobody's accepted, and also nobody's separate from the prisons. The Buddha activity isn't like, well, those people are in prison and I'm outside the prison. The Buddha activity, it goes into the prison because that's where its job is. So again, there's no difference between in the prison and liberation from the prison. There's no difference from consciousness and liberation of consciousness. Because liberation is, that's the job of liberation, is to be there with the consciousness. In conversation. Buddhas are in conversation every moment. If there's not a conversation, there's no Buddha. But fortunately, there is a conversation, and there is Buddha. And we can, you can understand that, I can understand that, but to really fully understand it, we have to let go of all these discriminations between things. So we've got lots of opportunities, and in order to become free of our discriminations, we have to love them. Not like them. You don't have to like your discriminations. And, of course, you don't dislike them. You love them. You practice compassion towards your discriminations. This is a nice person. This is a nicer person. This is a not nice person. This is a way below average person. All these discriminations, and they all can be traps if we're not kind to them. And Buddha activity is liberating, but it's also vastly compassionate to everything that's being liberated. And if the thing itself says, I'm not liberated, the compassion doesn't hold back on that. Were there some other conversation pieces?
Could I ask you a question?
You just did. You can do another one now.
Would it be accurate to say that the Buddhist activity of freeing all beings also has to be let go?
Yes. The activity of freeing beings has to be released. And that's where it is released. That's how it works. Yes.
So once that released, the thought of there is being, there is such a thing as being, that must be released.
That thought is a discrimination.
What is it?
The thought there is being,
yeah.
That's another discrimination.
Yeah, and that needs to go.
It doesn't really need to go. It just needs to be released.
Yeah, released.
It doesn't have to go anyplace. You don't have to go anyplace to be released. You can be released right here where you're sitting. You don't have to change seats.
Yeah, really, really.
I might ask you to move to another seat, but, you know, that's to release you from the seat you're in, not to go to another one. And I'm gonna, when you get to the other one, I'll release you then, too. But you're in a fine position for liberation right now. Mm-hmm. You've got enough problems to... Okay? So now, go ahead. Accept liberation.
So the thought itself, as it exists. So there's this thought exists.
There's a thought. The thought is, quote, it exists.
The thought is exists, yes.
So the thought is, quote, it exists, unquote.
I don't know what you mean, quote, unquote.
Well, are you saying that the thought, that like, here's the thought, okay, ready? It's Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying there's another thought called it exists?
Existence, yes. Yes,
yeah, that's a thought.
Yes.
Existence and non-existence are thoughts.
Uh-huh. So I'm kind of looking... Is there the space that it's neither nor?
Yeah, there's a space where it's not exactly neither, but just that there's a space which is free of existence and non-existence. And that's what the Buddha called the middle way. The Buddha way found the middle way between basically not just the thought of existence.
Yeah, so that...
Just a second, let me finish. The Buddha found the middle way between not just the thought of existence and the thought of non-existence. Because the thought of existence and the thought of non-existence are not really much of a problem unless you grasp them.
Mm-hmm.
So, we are generally speaking addicted to grasping existence and non-existence. Not just that this, like, birds, trees, sky. We're not addicted to grasping bird, tree, and sky the way we are to existence and non-existence. So the Buddha found the middle way, which is free of addiction to that. We, generally speaking, are addicted to it exists or doesn't. And by becoming free of the discrimination between existence and non-existence, we're free of that addiction. And the rest of them, too.
So would you say the addiction is when we need to use words or when we bring words into consciousness? The addiction to words?
It's like grasping in a habitual way as a way of coping with suffering. It's not just, you know, so we feel the need and we yield to the need of grasping.
Okay, thank you.
I'll be right with you, or the microphone will be right with you.
So I apologize if this is overly semantic, but you've said something once or twice, and Homa said something, and I think I'm being addicted to it. The word need. Do we need to do any of this? Do we need to liberate?
Yeah. Do we need to liberate?
Yeah. Do we? Yeah. Is any of this a need, or is everything that we do above a need?
We need liberation, and we need to be devoted to it, because we need to be in prison. So when you're born, you need to be in prison. Like, for example, you need to be in your mother's womb. When you come out, you need to be kind of like, you need to grasp your mother's breast or your bottle, or, you know, if babies don't grasp, humans and other primates, if they don't grasp with their little hands and mouth, they will not grow up to be Buddhas. But, you know, for the time being, they'll die. They have to grasp. It's necessary. It's needed to grasp. And then the same applies basically to our thoughts. We need to grasp them as part of life. And simultaneously, the grasping, even before we hear about it, this teaching, the grasping includes liberation from grasping, which is, life is really fundamentally liberation from grasping. And the reason it's also superficially grasping. It's both grasping includes liberation from grasping, and liberation from grasping, of course, is totally engaged with grasping. So we need both to grasp. We need to, you know, living beings are a confinement in the universe to a particular place and time and grasping. And also the whole universe is working with that being to be free of being stuck. We need both. And we've got both. Now, most people know, a lot of people know anyway, that off and on, that they're trapped and that they're stressed. But they don't understand that necessarily they're in the process of becoming free of this entrapment. But they are. We need to be what we are. And we need to be what we are. And what we are is that we're what we are, and we're also not what we are. That's what we are. We're not just what we are, we're also not what we are. We're otherwise. We're both. We're self and we're others. Yes?
Presently, I'm feeling fear.
Presently, you're feeling fear?
Presently, I'm feeling fear. I'm feeling entrapment. And my mind is thinking, we can have conversation to liberate all beings. Yet if we're not silent and still, I'm having trouble seeing how that's possible.
Did you hear what she said? It sounds like she thinks that silence and stillness is necessary.
Yes.
But she doesn't understand that it can be present and functioning when we're having a conversation.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Wholehearted conversation, ladies and gentlemen, and other people. Conversation, did I say? It, when it's wholehearted, the conversation remembers silence and stillness. Do you hear that? If you forget silence and stillness, your conversation will have difficulty realizing fully what it is. So, you know, so many Zen stories are about people who remember silence and talk to each other. And while they're talking, they're able to remember it, and that helps them really wholeheartedly converse. The etymology of the word converse means intimate or familiar. We are already in conversation, but we need to practice it, and to practice it wholeheartedly, because we're already wholeheartedly in conversation. Already, really. And yet, part of the conversation is that we feel like we're not wholehearted about it, and we don't want to talk to some people. That's part of the conversation, sometimes. And remembering silence and stillness is part of the wholeheartedness program. This afternoon, when supposedly we're going to hear a lot of noise, I will probably say again this afternoon, but I'll say it now. I pray that you remember silence and stillness when the noise comes. It is possible to remember silence when there's lots of noise. That's part of our responsibility, is to remember silence. But also part of our responsibility is to talk. Not just be quiet, but to speak. Sometimes. And to be quiet others. But even when you're speaking, remember the silence. And even when you're silent, remember the conversation. When you're quiet and remembering stillness, you can still remember the conversation you're having with all beings. You're not just being silent for your own serenity, you're being silent for everybody in Sacramento. Your silence is what you're offering to everybody in Sacramento. Right? Even if you don't think so, that's what's going on. You're living for the welfare of all beings. And the Buddha is, the historical Buddha is called the silent one of the Shakya clan. Shakya Muni means a silent one. So he talked quite a bit. The historical Buddha talked quite a bit. But he remembered silence when he spoke, and you can remember silence when you speak. And when you're silent and you're not speaking, you can remember the conversation that you're having with all beings. Because you are. You're supporting them, they're supporting you. That's the conversation. Does that take care of you for the time being really well?
Yes.
When we were starting this Dharma Center, there was a person on the planning committee with me, and he and I would get on the phone, and we would have extremely animated conversations, and somebody I lived with would overhear these conversations, and they would think, "Oh, you know, you guys are just never going to agree, or you're really out of control, and so forth." But conversations have different styles.
Mm-hmm.
And some people hear conversations and I feel like I'm misunderstood sometimes because I stick strongly to a view. It appears that I do, but I'm sticking to the view because I'm promoting the view. But I'm always thinking, I'm not really stuck on this view, but I just want people to know what it is, you know? but it seems like, I guess what happens is, they don't see that I'm not sticking to the view. They don't see that part. So then they think I'm sticking to the view, and people get upset. So, I don't know if you have any... It seems to take away from my argument. If I tell people I'm not sticking to my view, then they say, well, then stick to our view, you know.
So, you could say instead of if I'm proposing something with enthusiasm, if I would tell people that I'm not stuck to what I'm proposing, you might say that my argument's losing something.
Yeah.
But it's more like if you're proposing something enthusiastically and you tell people that you're not attached to it, that you give away your argument. It isn't that your argument loses something. You give your argument away. And when you give it away, still they may not believe you're really giving it. But if you're not attached to it, you can be even more fully enthusiastic about it.
That's exactly how enthusiastic.
Yeah, and then you can tell them that. You say, I'm giving this away, and they say, well, then we're not going to do it. And you say, great, I'm totally accept that, and now I want to say it again.
Yeah.
So, and you can tell in yourself sometimes that you're offering something, and you're holding to it. If your mind is calm and you offer something and you're holding to it, your mind becomes agitated and disturbed. But you sometimes say, oh, I have this great idea I'm going to offer. Here it is. And I just give it to you. And you feel completely at peace. And people say, you know, you're attached to it. And then when that idea comes that you're attached to it, and you like deal with that the same way you dealt with that other one, you're totally enthusiastic about receiving their accusation that you're attached to your view.
And well, then I'm totally enthusiastic about seeing their disagreement with my view.
Yeah.
And ultimately, if there's a lot of disagreement, then I ultimately, after an hour and a half, I yield, you know, and say. But sometimes, people remember the hour and a half more than they remember the last 5 minutes. So,
So I didn't necessarily agree that ultimately you're going to yield. You could yield at the beginning,
yeah,
and then continue. So when you were talking, I thought you were describing the essence of democracy. The heart of democracy is conversing with people we disagree with. To continue the conversation, even though we may never agree. Everybody agreeing is like, I don't know what, totalitarianism, you know, temporarily. Everybody in this country agrees. Mm-hmm, yeah. Because anybody who doesn't, you know, is treated with unkindness or elimination. So the heart of democracy is, one of the problems with the word democracy is it has a crassy at the end. Crassy. Which I think means power, doesn't it? Does it mean power? I think power to the people. So anyway, there is power, and to have conversations about it, which may never end, it's an ongoing process of conversation. And then can we be in the conversation so wholeheartedly that we're not attached to what we offer to it? And I would say yes. We are learning to do that. We're learning to express what we think is good, express what we think is not good, wholeheartedly, and in the wholehearted expression, we will realize freedom from our expression. And that will promote other people's realization of their expression, which we don't agree with. But we're free together, having different views. And we're at peace with each other. We're not trying to kill each other or harm each other. As you know, some people actually want harm to come to those who disagree with them. Perhaps many of us have had thoughts like that in our life, that we would like harm to come to people who disagree with us. And I remember when Obama became president, I heard for the first time really clearly a peaceful transition of power. It didn't take a lot of people getting killed for him to become president, even though some people disagreed with it. And then we had other people following. Did you notice? But not, you know, and there were crimes maybe involved, but people, it wasn't a war to transfer the power. And now we're having these, we're continuing this very enthusiastic conversation, and each of these conversations are opportunities for the people involved to see if they're adhering to their position, and if so, to see that that doesn't help. It doesn't make things go smoothly and peacefully, and things can go peacefully and government can change from this president to that president and then to another one. So there is going to change, things are going to change, but can there be peace through the process? And sometimes it seems like we don't see the peace. We see war, we see hostility, we see it. Buddhism doesn't eliminate this. Buddhism is working to realize peace now with the current level of war, with the current level of people holding on. When we hold on, we have war. We have strife. We have hatred. Right? That's been going on for a while, as far as I can see. I don't see it ending, but I'm talking about a continuous involvement in Buddha activity in the face of fear and attachment, hatred, and disrespect, and so on. All those negative things come up with the attachment to our views. We're in the process of not diminishing our views, but giving up attachment to them. And when you give up attachment to them, you have more energy for them. And more energy for patience with them not being agreed upon. Yes.
It's also my experience that in a conversation where there are different views, that if we listen to each other's views, that often then changes our understanding of our own view.
Yes.
And so it's not a fixed view anymore, or going back and forth with different fixed views.
Yeah.
Everything is sort of transformed in that kind of a process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So listening, surprise, is part of the Buddha activity. Listening, surprise, is part of conversation. And then sometimes we see ourselves in a conversation and we may notice, oops, I haven't been listening. I, the virtuous one, have not been listening. I think there's something off. Oh yeah, I'm supposed to be listening while I'm talking and listening while they're talking. And I forgot. So part of the conversation process we're in, part of the Buddha activity, is to notice again when we're clinging, which again kind of makes it hard to see the Buddha activity. So listening is remembering silence and stillness. When you're silent, you can listen better. And while you're talking, you can remember silence. I think I said when you're silent, you can hear better. When you remember silence, you can hear better, because you can remember silence when you're talking. So you're not being silent, people might say. You're talking. And you might say, yeah, and I can say more too. You want to hear? And they say, yeah. While I'm talking, I'm remembering silence. And then they go, wow. And when I said, wow, I remembered silence. Silence is always here. It's not something you make. It's something that's here, and you can remember it. Buddha activity is not something you make. It's something we all are doing together. And we can remember it. It doesn't go or come. It's free of going and coming. It doesn't exist or not exist. It's free of existence and non-existence. It's a freedom which is free of freedom. And we don't make it, we remember it, and remembering it realizes it. Listening to it realizes it. Being respectful of every being realizes it. That's what we're doing. We're in the process of learning to respect everybody, even the people we really disagree with, even people who are really frightened. Respect frightened people who, because they're frightened, tell you that they're perfect and tell you that everybody else is an idiot. That's the way people talk when they're afraid. Right? Frightened people are at risk of being bullies. Right? Respect bullies? Does Buddha respect bullies? Yes. Does Buddha see that the bully is frightened? A frightened child? Yes. Does Buddha let go of her view of that person? Yes. Does that facilitate Buddha's devotion to that person? Yes. Does Buddha teach that person how to face their fear? Yes. When the person faces their fear, do they stop being a bully? Yes. And when they face it fully, when they have a wholehearted conversation with their fear, they become free of it and they become free of being a bully. But we have to respect everything in order to, a part of facilitating this process, which is already going on, is to respect everybody in the process, and everybody's in it. I see one, two.
Thank you. I had the thought arise when that one thing that changes the conversation if someone seems to be attached to their view is to ask them or to inquire about what they're afraid of if that doesn't happen. But as the conversation continued and you were speaking, I thought if you try to inquire about what they're concerned about or afraid of, if it doesn't happen, and then somebody says, I'm not afraid of anything, is kind of a conversation stopper again. And then I kind of got stuck with how to turn a moment when there's the expression of, I'm not afraid. I see that when you drop to how you're feeling, then it changes the conversation. But if you don't go back and forth around that with someone, then you're kind of stuck, it seems.
Now, if I were to disagree with you, would that stop the conversation?
It might. Maybe I would continue with, what do you disagree with? Maybe I would continue it that way. It might stop it, but maybe I'd try to find out more about what you disagree with.
If you did, would the conversation go on?
It might. If you tell me, it might.
No, I mean, you just said some stuff,
yeah.
And then I asked you, if I disagree with you, does that stop the conversation?
Not necessarily.
I would say definitely does continue the conversation.
Yeah.
When you say something and I disagree with you, that's the next moment of the conversation.
Right.
It's not a conversation stopper. It's a conversation facilitator.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you say to me after you say it stopped, yeah, if you then say blah, blah to me, that continues. Everything you do, everything I do,
mm-hmm,
continues the conversation, including the conversation is now concluded. That is not a conversation stopper. That is a conversation And then the person says, the conversation is concluded. There is going to be no more conversation. And then someone says, oh, could I ask a question to clarify what you just said? No, you cannot. You cannot ask any more questions. Did you want me to not say anything more? I didn't want you to say that.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Just what you're doing.
that's the way the conversation looks.
Yeah.
Is I don't want to talk to you anymore.
That's a conversation stopper for me.
Yeah. And for me, it's not. For me, somebody telling me they don't want to talk to me is a conversation starter, or, you know, it's a conversation initiator, it's a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of a secret, don't tell anybody, okay? But when I was in college, I met some young women who were also in college who would come up to me and basically say, I don't want to talk to you. I mean, they would like go out of their way and come over and say, I don't want to talk to you. And I would go, wow, that's really interesting. You know, tell me more about it. And they would. They'd tell me maybe why they didn't want to talk to me. And, oh, wow. And they would see that I was so interested in them. They would see that, yeah, that what they said was very attractive.
So they tried it some more.
And some of those people, yeah, the conversation went on quite a while. And in other words, the intimacy developed. But it started with, the first thing I noticed, well, I sort of noticed their face, and I guess I noticed their face enough so that they came over and told me that they didn't want to talk to me. But then I got much more interested. Not everybody has that kind of history, but that, you know. And that was when I was in college, you know. I was in my late teens, early 20s. I don't want to have a conversation with you. I don't want to talk to you was the initiation of a quite an extensive conversation. Almost never has, in those days, did a woman come up to me and say, I want to have a conversation with you. I don't remember any examples of that. Could I talk to you? Could we have a relationship? No, but other. And when I was even younger, when I was 7, or, you know, just before I was 8, it was my birthday's in the summer, so it was in the summer, you know, in Minnesota, and you know it's in the summer because there's no snow. Which is only in the summer, is there no snow. Back in those days. So anyway, it was summertime, there was grass in the ground, and me and some other boys were playing tag. And there were some girls sitting next by, several girls, maybe 3 or 4. And every time we ran by the girls in our tag game, one of the girls stuck out her tongue at me. She didn't have her tongue permanently out. It was like it went out at certain times. And the time hers went out was when I went by. And then it would go back in. And then I'd come by again, and it came out again. And I think also the tongue came with some audio support. Something like, She was like, she was like, got my attention. And I started to get irritated, actually. And so at a certain point, I stopped playing tag and I ran after her. I ran over to her and she got up and ran away. I was going to, I think, hit her or something for doing that to me. That was like, my attention was, I'm not going to punch her or something. And she ran. And somehow I caught up with her and I pushed her down on the ground and I was going to hit her. And she just looked at me. like, hello. You know, here you are, just as I wished. I wish I could go back at that moment and see that face. It did not make me want to hit her anymore. So I kissed her and said. And she seemed like, yeah, finally you understand what's going on. That was the way she got me to kiss her. Even though she wasn't in control of me, that's what she wanted, and she wanted to do that more too. So anyway, we're on the path of becoming intimate with each other. And sometimes the way we do it is, I don't want to talk to you anymore. Like some people have loved ones who have addiction problems, and they say, I don't want to live with you anymore. I'm not going to live with you if you keep up these abusive behaviors with yourself and with us too. So I'm moving out. This is a conversation. It's not the end of a relationship to move out when somebody's behaving inappropriately. And you don't have to be attached to your position. You can wholeheartedly move out without trying to control them. And it's part of the ongoing process by which you and that other person are going to become free and dwell in peace with each other. But that's an intense conversation. I'm moving out. But there was an intense conversation going on before, which was called abusive, and which you felt like, well, I think I should leave. So all these situations I'm saying are in this overall process of becoming free. Anything else at this time? Yes, Valerie.
Could you talk a little bit about remembering silence? Is it just a cognitive thing where you're sitting there in the conversation remembering silence, or is there something else going on?
I wouldn't say it's just cognitive. For example, like in this retreat, you're sitting, and you may cognitively think, remember silence. That's cognitive. But also, your body may allow you to do it again, perhaps by not moving, not leaving your seat. So your physical setup in this particular situation, your body's cooperating too. So it isn't just cognitive. And also, when you cognitively remember stillness, it transforms your unconscious process. So we have our conscious mind, but we also have an unconscious mind. And when you remember stillness, your unconscious mind is transformed. The actual act of remembering stillness transforms your unconscious process, which is, in a way, it's a little bit more intimate with your body. So then your body changes. And when your body changes, then your unconscious process changes, which then also gives rise, perhaps, to another cognition, remember stillness. This is a kind of reinforcing system of transforming the body and helping the body relax by remembering stillness and silence. So it's cognitive, it's conscious cognitive, unconscious cognitive, and physical. And these three work together to develop another kind of cognition, which is the actual mind of the Buddha activity. The way you remembering stillness transforms me. When you remember stillness, it transforms your unconscious and your body. But when your body gets transformed, it transforms my body. So your practice then changes my practice, John's practice. So it's not just cognitive. It's interpenetrating the whole world. And also you're not in control of remembering, but by various causes and conditions, for example, me saying that to you, now you're thinking of it. But I didn't control you to think of it. but in fact I did bring it up and you are thinking of it, but somebody else may not. Anyway, I'm doing this with you, you're doing this with me. So it's cognitive, conscious, it's cognitive, unconscious, it's physical, and it's also relational. Because everything you think affects all of us. And everything you think is because we're all around you. So in this way, this is the Buddha activity. This is the process of freeing beings. Is that enough for now?
Yeah.
Hmm? Okay. I'm going to try a little chant and I'll see if you people know it. Ready? It's a dedication of the merit of our conversation. And then it's an expression of vows. Our Buddha activity vows. Okay? May our intention extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Walking meditation.